Hey, weirdos and queerdos, and welcome to another episode of Attention Confidential, the podcast where we explore self-awareness, curiosity, and advocacy in a safe container. I am your host, Maggie Green, here to remind you that your voice matters and your stories are safe with me. In support of safety, please be advised that this podcast contains explicit language and direct or indirect references to material which some listeners may find triggering. Topics are highly personal and intimate, likely to touch on themes including but not limited to abuse, bigotry, body image, disability, mental health, sexuality, and trauma. Please prioritize your safety and the safety of those around you who may be exposed to this material, especially young folks. Please also note, this is an ongoing project, which means I am actively engaged in learning while creating. The format, the tools, and skills to produce this material are all new to me. As I build and refine, I ask that you understand there may be kinks along the way. And because transparency is one of my core values, I should also share that I am using software that includes enhanced features to simplify the editing and post-production process. Any editing of this content, however, this original, organic, human-generated content, is done so at my discretion, specifically to optimize sound quality, not to manipulate, omit, or alter any substantive material in the recordings. All guests have a chance to review the material before it is published so that they can be assured their voices and stories are held and shared with care, treated as sacred things to preserve and pass on. You can find more details about each guest and relevant resources in the show notes for each episode. Sharing our identities with others is such a generous gift, and today's guest has chosen to share theirs with us.
Very excited to welcome Jess to the show today. Jess uses she/her pronouns, identifies as a Buddhist minister, a biker, a sneakerhead, and a lover of all things punk, among many other details. Jess, want to tell the listeners a little bit about yourself?
Thank you. Hello, everyone. Yes, kind of all those things that you just mentioned. I also I work in information security. I'm at the top of my profession as a chief information security officer. Which I enjoy doing. I've been in information technology and information security for 30 years, and that's kind of my main profession. But then I also have a side business that I'm doing called Vigilant Violet, which is security services and security coaching services. And I have a podcast, Voices of the Vigilant, that I do as part of that. And when I'm not doing all that, I'm spending time with either my adult kids or my grandkids. And yeah, that's a little bit of who I am.
Thank you for sharing that. So as mentioned, we're going to explore three things. So our first segment is the mirror, which is really all about self-awareness, self-reflection. I love metaphor, if you can't tell already. So I am very curious to know, when you think about self-awareness, self-reflection, your mirror, what is something that you might want to share with listeners? This is a great space for that. I think you had mentioned continuous learning, discovering your authentic self. I love that phrase. You want to tell us a little bit more about that? What have you learned?
Like, it feels like that's my whole life at this point. So I didn't come out as transgender until probably 6 or 7 years ago, even though I knew it since I was very young. I have looked at myself intensely over the course of my life to this point. I'm in my mid-50s, and I've always wanted to explore and learn more about who I am and if I'm alone. Obviously, when I was younger in the 70s and 80s, there was no internet for me to reference. There was no real way for me to understand why I felt as different as I was. The first time I think that I realized that there were others like me out there was because I read so much. I read everything that was in the house. And my mother had a Woman's Day magazine that was out. And I always read that, like, cover to cover. Anything that I could read, I read. It didn't matter what it was. And I happened to pick it up, and there was an article about a transgender woman in it. And as I read through the article, I realized, I'm not broken. I'm not wrong. Like, there's other people like me out there. And then there is a way to live that makes sense to who I am. Because I knew from, like, 6 or 7 that I was I just felt like I was in the wrong body. The first time I realized that there was a difference between what the society says is a male and female physically, I knew I didn't fit in the body I was in. Really, that just fed that curiosity that I have, and I continued to just read and search out knowledge. And really, it wasn't until the early 2000s when I could start to feel, okay, maybe I can live the life that I want to live. Because I wasn't happy. I knew I wasn't happy. And it came out in so many ways. A lot of anger. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of anger. You mentioned me being a punk. And when I was younger, that was how I dealt with that part of who I couldn't be, was to make myself prickly. Like, push people away and make myself scary. And that was a way of protecting myself. But I think I had so much of a lens on myself that I was trying to figure out who I am and why I am the way I am and how can I live the way I want to live, that helped feed that curiosity about learning about other people and different ways of living and how can I accept myself and how can I accept others like me and get to a point in my life where I could be happy and I wasn't trying to bury it all under drinking or violence or being angry. I mean, I did everything possible to shut it away. I went as far to try and be masculine as I thought I should be to protect myself. I played tough sports like rugby. I pledged a fraternity. I joined the Marines and went to boot camp. And then I said, oh, I want to be an officer in the Marines. So I went to boot camp again, which is officer candidate school. Went and got a motorcycle, jumped out of planes, learned scuba diving, just everything to try and say, can I fit the way society wants me to fit? And then I picked up a book around 2018, I guess it was. I was going to a conference in San Antonio, and I was, you know, when you come back, the bookstores are right there. And I went to Starbucks, I grabbed a coffee at that point. I was still drinking coffee then. And you had to go through the bookstore to get out. And there was a book called Un-F Yourself. I don't know if we can swear here. So
no, please do it.
And I had two flights to come home, and I started reading the book. And I think I was 3/4 of the way through the book on the first leg of the flight. And in my head, this voice went, oh no. And then I got on the second flight and I read the rest of the book. And I remember I walked off that plane, and that day we couldn't pull to the gate, so they had the stairs that come up. I remember it vividly. And I walked out, put my first foot on the first step of the stairway down, and I said, I'm transgender. And I have to admit it to myself. I have to come out and live this way, and I don't know how I'm going to do this. It was a good and bad point. For me, some people talk about cracking your egg as mm-hmm. someone who's transgender. I guess that was the moment that it really cracked, even though I already knew it. But I realized, I guess what I would say is I started to come apart at that point. And at the same time, I had applied for this job promotion, regional, like really high up promotion. And I'd always gotten every job I applied to. And on this day, or on this opportunity, what I didn't realize is that it had already been politically engineered. So I did all these interviews. It was 3 days of interviews, 8 hours a day. And I didn't get the position. And the person who told me said it was political and you were never going to get the position. It wasn't your fault. They were telling me the inside story. So that further pushed me down. And I had a break. You know, it wouldn't be diagnosed as by a... I didn't go to a therapist to say, you've had a mental breakdown, but I had a mental breakdown. And it was at that point where I was sinking into depression, really deep depression. My spouse was asking me, what's wrong? And I finally just broke down. And everything that I had ever kept to myself, everything I had compartmentalized, I just let it all flow out at that point because I was at so far down that I didn't care if I died. I didn't care if my life blew up. I just needed the pain to be over. I needed to be past all of that. The book helped explain that it created all these boxes. I put everything in, and I was controlling it so much that all my misery was the result of those decisions I made, and I had to undecide all those things. Thank God I have just an amazing spouse who dealt with my depression in a way that is very amazing. If anyone listening has never had depression, you can't find your way out. It's It's dark. You don't have energy. Your brain works against... It's like being attacked from the inside is how I felt it was. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't eat. I cried all the time. My wife would just hold me for hours as I was crying. And finally she said, "You, one, stop drinking." Which, hello, yeah, that's a good idea, because that's a depressant. And two, go talk to a therapist. So I went to talk to the therapist, and it took probably 6 or 7 months of going every week to get to a point at which I could hold myself together. And then one night, thankfully, I had a nightmare. It was the worst nightmare ever. But in that nightmare, something snapped. Like, my brain figured out the problem and figured out how to get me out of everything. And it instilled me with all this fortitude all of a sudden. And I just said, I can do this. I have to do this, because here's the alternatives. I do it or I die. Mm. And I was so depressed that when I was left alone at the house, there were two times I went out to my garage. I made a noose and I sat there holding the noose because I just wanted to end it. And it wasn't, I don't even know how to explain that. It's like visually, I was looking at this well of darkness in a room of darkness. And I was just like, I gotta get out of the darkness. Like, I want the darkness to end. But through all that, through her insight and support, I was able to work through that and never went back there. And at that point, when I started my transition, I was going to therapy. I got on hormones. That's when my world went from being monochromatic, to just so bright, so vivid, where I couldn't see others because I was so in myself with so much pain. I could see everything and everyone and the beauty of it.
Technicolor, yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing. And that's how my, every day since then, that's how my life has been. Hormones, for people who need them, are so important. I didn't realize what my body knew. I needed estrogen. And so I had dysphoria, gender dysphoria, body dysphoria. And so the first part of transition helped that, but it's also the darkest part, right? Because you're not any gender, you're not comfortable. But you start to work through that. But then when I had the hormones, it was like, my brain's been missing this the whole time. This is incredible. Like, wow, this is like, I can think the way I'm supposed to think. And then when I looked in the mirror, I could see me. And over time, for a transgender person, at least for me, the more time goes by and the more you start living the way you want to live and appearing the way you want to appear, it's just, it's incredible. Getting past that point allowed me to get to a place in which now I could explore all the things I was interested in, because now I was no longer stuck on myself. I was moved past that point. The only disappointment I have in life is that my life is going to be shorter than I want it to be, because I want to be out there learning everything, meeting everyone, experiencing everything, because I deprived myself of 50-something years of doing that. What I can only assume other people who are comfortable in their gender or their gender aligns with their assignment at birth, how they've lived their whole lives. And now I'm trying to make up for it now. And, you know, doing this, right? You said, would you be interested in doing this? Absolutely. Like, it's like being in the best, biggest restaurant in the world, and there's all these foods. I'm like, I'm going to taste that. I'm going to taste that. I'm going to taste that. I'm gonna taste.
Yes.
And you just keep going. And you're like, I don't know if I can get to the end, but I'm going to try. And so, yeah, that's where I'm at. That's where I used to be so focused inside because I was so miserable. Now I'm so focused outside. It's been great. It allows me to be present. It allows me to be loving and caring. It allows me to be engaged. It allows me to learn. Another thing we've talked about is when I went through my Buddhist studies, we have a sensei who ran the school that we were part of, or the Sangha. And then we have individuals that teach different courses. They're all called senseis. But the sensei in charge of the school gives us our name when we graduate. I did 2 years of studies, and I only met him a handful of times. And he was giving out names. So the second part of the name means sun, but the first part he gave me means open sky of the mind. So I got the name Kuyo. And I was just amazed that he picked up on that. And he said, you're always out there searching, you're always out there, you know, listening, bringing things in, asking questions, trying to just go further. I think that meant a lot to me, because not only did I know I was authentic, but I knew that other people could see it.
the wash of validation coming from that. Like, you're finally you. And, you know, we use the metaphor of a mirror, right? And you've referenced the literal standing in front of a mirror and seeing the evolution of yourself. But having someone hold up to you a metaphorical mirror and show back to you, like, I see you. This is you. I have goosebumps right now, Jess. That's really, really powerful. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
As you were telling the story of this self-discovery journey, I heard a few very distinct milestones. So, the Women's Day magazine, I'm thinking, tell me, is this the 80s? Is this the 90s? Was it back in the 70s?
Probably mid-80s, I'm guessing.
Okay. And then you have early 2000s, and then you have the 2018 moment of the Unfuck Yourself book.
Yep.
On the airplane, stairs, getting onto the tarmac. What is happening right before the early 2000s? Was it the internet? Like, what happened? What was different there that sort of opened things up, gave you access to the language or the concept to even know, like, the Women's Day in the 80s. Just curious, like, maybe what was going on in the world then, too.
Yeah, so, you know, the late 90s, for those of you who were born after the late 90s, we didn't always have the internet available.
Right.
And so it was slowly evolving, and there was AOL, and AOL had chat rooms, so I could jump into some of these chat rooms somewhat anonymously and just have conversations with people. And that's where I started to have conversations with people across the LGBTQ spectrum. I met other transgender people, and I met people who were gay and bi and lesbian. For me, having grown up in rural New Hampshire, I hadn't been exposed to any of this. I hadn't been exposed to a lot of different cultures, let alone people across a gender spectrum and a sexual orientation spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't been exposed to it. So it was the first part of realizing how normal it is, how everyone's just people.
Yeah.
And we all just are unique, really understanding uniqueness. That availability of communication, of finding out there's others like you and having open conversations and safe conversations, so important. I still hadn't figured out how to live my life. And quite frankly, in the 90s and early 2000s, it was still, even with all the changes coming out, right? Even with Stonewall and all that stuff that had preceded, it was still such a slow evolution. You know, I could have never come out in the 80s. I was convinced that if I did, I would be killed. I saw how people who came out and admitted that they were gay or lesbian were treated. I just thought, for sure, you know, I'm not even going to get as much limited space as they're getting. I can't say anything, but certainly, you know, around the grunge era, late 90s, going into 2000, that started to change because you started to have people who were comfortable in their gender but were pushing those edges, right? And were comfortable in letting people wonder, you know, are they a straight white male or are they pushing, you know, with what they're wearing and stuff to start signaling who they are? And then finally, people started to come right out, right? Really, I remember one incident that made me start to feel real comfortable. If you've heard of Laura Jane Grace, right? Big punk singer. If you go back into her past, you can see she presented very masculine, not knowing that story. But then when it came out in Rolling Stone, and she came out and said, this is who I am, and read the article, I was like, if that person can do it, I can do it. I mean, because I'm not up on a stage. I'm not a performer. That's a big deal. So that was one of those things that gave me confidence, which is why it's so important that we have community and we have people who, they don't have to be on a stage, but if they're just themselves and they don't have any qualms about saying, I'm transgender or I'm gay or I'm bi or what have you, that breaks down all these boxes we've created to other people, and it makes it easier for people, one, to be themselves, but two, other people to understand. Like, this is perfectly normal. Science backs us up. Even though a lot of people are denying science these days, science backs us up. Gender is on a spectrum. Sexuality is on a spectrum. Humanity is on a spectrum. There is no normal. Like, where the heck do you get that from? Brown eyes? Blue eyes?
Right.
Hazel eyes? And it doesn't make anyone less. You know, for a long time, people didn't understand neurodiversity. or people who were different, and they built places to put these people, or they didn't deal with it, or they labeled them as just being problem. Mm-hmm. But then once we started to apply science to it and started taking the time to understand, we realized, oh my God, this is what a superpower,
right?
You know, and I have people in my family who are neurodiverse, and I think it's the most beautiful thing that ever happened to our family, is having them as a member of the family, because I learned to see things different ways, and seeing how they view the world opens up a whole new perspective. It makes it much easier for you to think in different viewpoints and give room for people, and it makes you a better person. Really, when we expose ourselves to things that we haven't been exposed to before, I think it makes us more well-rounded, makes us stronger. I won't say it makes us better, but it certainly makes the world better.
There were a couple of other things that stuck out to me as you were sharing as well. This notion of you are not alone, and how many people are moving through the world, you know, navigating depression, certainly a mental health challenge that I have experienced myself regularly. I tell people, you know, part of my bio is I have chronic anxiety. Well, chronic anxiety and depression are BFFs, right? That's always one with the other. So the notion that you're not alone, but also this, like, the introduction of the internet and these communities of people who maybe are not in your neighborhood, but still there's shared experience, shared connection, and how important that connectivity has been for, on an individual level, but society in general. Like, this is your first experience having a conversation with someone who has anything in common with you, right? You grew up thinking, like, I'm the only person, you know, dealing with this, and just how powerful that is. Also, your commentary about neurodivergence and humanity in general, I think might be a really good, let's say, transition into the next segment, which is the magnifying glass. When I asked you what you wanted to kind of look at close up in detail, you said the meaning of life, which is huge, right? Like, that is... Where do you even begin? So when you are contemplating the meaning of life, what are some of the thoughts that go through your head? What are the questions that you ask yourself? What can you share? What do you know so far?
I'm still learning, as I mentioned. I appreciate that Buddhism came into my life, and that's the way I live my life, because it gives me a way to consider things that I'm experiencing. And Buddhists will tell you that enlightenment is not a destination, it's the path can be part of enlightenment. And we can have what's called Dharma glimpses, where there's these moments where you say, oh, wow, I was really present right now, and I just understood everything that just happened in this moment. And those are great, but we also try not to just pursue those, right? Because that's grasping, and that is contrary to what Buddhism talks about. So
yeah.
We try and be present in each moment and just recognize every moment for what it is. And part of doing that is saying, I am a biological creature. I have electrical impulses that run through me and chemical reactions that are happening in me, and all of that affects me in any particular moment. And I'm never the same in any particular moment, because there's tens of thousands of variations of what can happen in any given moment. And I can go down a whole Nietzsche path with this.
Yeah.
And we could talk about multi-dimensionality and all that. And that, I think, for me personally, I believe that all exists, right? There's all these things that can happen. If we look at mathematical probabilities and scientific reasoning, that's all realistic. I'll never live long enough in this lifetime to understand all of it. But I'm so curious about picking up the elements of it as I'm going through. And Buddhism, it's like being given vision into this world. Past what you're used to. And I'm using vision very loosely for any Buddhists out there, because I understand all about the senses and how senses can lie to us. But yeah, so when I think of the meaning of life, for me, it's being present. And the most important thing for me right now, I'm a Mahayana Buddhist, so I believe that giving to others, helping others, that's my purpose. So when I look at the meaning of life, it's how do I leave this life and the people that have experienced me, I guess that's the only way I can say it, experienced me or met me, in a better place than than they were. And so I'm very intentional about the Eightfold Path, and I'm very intentional about how I speak to people and how I act and the jobs I take and the things I do in my life. So for me, the meaning is in the action to create karma and as a wave in the ocean to have the positive or better energy for everyone. Because if we can put that out, it starts reflecting, right? One wave hits another wave, hits another wave, hits another wave, passes that energy along. And we can pass energy that is useful or energy that is less than useful. And I want to be useful in any way I can. And I don't look at it as, hey, I want a great rebirth.
Yeah, you're not racking up points, like karmic points.
No, and that's, again, that would be so contrary to being a Buddhist.
Right.
You don't do it for a purpose, you just do it. And you can choose how you want to live your life. And I have been able to choose. And once I realized I could choose, and I could choose over and over and over and over again, then that's been good. So the meaning of life for me is to be present, is to be loving, is to be kind, is to be positive, is to just be honest and open as to who I am. And I'm loving my life. You know, the closet was one small part of me. You know, coming out of the closet was one small part of me realizing how to live. And then, you know, being transgender is one small part of me, and being Buddhist is one small part of me. But all these parts make up the me that I am today, that everyone knows. And I don't know. I'm living my best life despite everything, the chaos around me. And it was the same way during the pandemic when I was really going through my transition, the heart of it. I was thriving, and which will seem odd to a lot of people that will look around today and go, how in this world there's so much misery and stuff? Yeah, there's a lot of misery, but there's a lot of good stuff. And we can keep trying to take positive or helpful actions, and we can affect that stuff that's not so positive out in the world. We'll always have it. If we didn't have it, right? If we didn't have these less than optimal times, we wouldn't appreciate the optimal times. And if we had the optimal times all the time, we wouldn't know what optimal was anymore. So
I was sitting here thinking, you know, I studied a bit of East Asian religion and philosophy in college. It was some of my favorite coursework. In fact, religion as an institution and a concept or subject matter was like repulsive. I was like, oh, but that fear and misunderstanding drew me to it. I was like, I need to learn more. I think we have that piece in common. Like, right. I want to know the things that it occurs to me as I'm thinking about what little I know about Buddhism, Taoism. Some of the questions that maybe even listeners might be considering, like, what might they want to ask Jess? Like, how do you know if you're getting it right? Or what tells you when you get it wrong? Like, it's a contradiction in terms. Like, that's not the right question, right? Like, we got to dig deeper.
Yes.
You're missing the point if you're trying to get it right, or if you're trying to get there faster, or even the concept of the there. Like, you know, the path, the journey itself is the destination, not a fixed point. We're not, like, keeping a tally of here are my good deeds, which equates to whatever. And that is really striking, especially when we keep things like capitalism in mind, right? And this urgency and productivity and all these things. Something else I was thinking too is this living a life of service and doing it for the doing of it, right? Not to impress someone or, again, like rack up karmic points. How do you distinguish that approach from something like martyrdom? And I bring this up because as a recovering people pleaser, who keeps the company of a lot of recovering people pleasers who are at various stages in that journey, it's like service to others always feels like the right thing to do, and we really enjoy that. And I don't know, I'm catching myself even as I'm asking this question, like, what about you, right? Like, where's the self? How do you nurture that so you can be there for others? And Buddhism totally dismantles and deconstructs the concept of self. So, like, how do you get what you need? How can you be of service to others and get what you need as well? Is that even the right question?
Sure. Oh, it's a good question.
What is the balance?
It's tricky to ask. It's tricky. Very tricky to ask that because there is no self.
Right.
Trying to think of a way to relate how I've learned it. So I don't intentionally take actions to be positive or negative. That would mean I'm thinking into the future, right? sometimes everyone daydreams, and that's perfect. That's being human, right? And Buddhism says, don't shut down the feelings, like experience the feelings, but understand them, look at them, understand why you're feeling the way you are. How do you know if you're doing it the right way? Or it's tricky. I just say, for me, it's just a feeling, like I know. Like, here's my feeling. How do I want to react? And if I react to a feeling with anger, well, anger is natural. How do I deal with that? Did I lash out at someone? Does that create a positive outcome? What's the damage I do, right? Because then I look at the Eightfold Path and I'm like, okay, I wasn't speaking carefully or skillfully there. So, and let's say that does happen, right? Then it's the point of saying, I did this. Now what do I do? I could just leave it and the person is hurt, or I could say, I made a mistake. I'm sorry. What can I do to fix what I just did? And so now you're coming back around to that event. It's situational and it's in the instant. It's hard. I will never be able to give anyone who asks me questions about Buddhism a right or wrong answer. There's a saying, if you see the Buddha, kill the Buddha. Because you can't know. And now you've made a decision. That's the Buddha. Well, everyone has Buddhahood. Everyone could be a Buddha.
Right.
So you don't know that that's the Buddha. You're making a decision.
Right.
That is based in nothingness. So it's very, as hard as it was for you to ask that question, it's equally hard for me to answer that question, because my answer was only pertinent to me in this one incident where you asked me this question.
Yeah.
And it could be completely different for you in your next situation. If I kept it very basic, I would just say, try to have the right intentions, the right viewpoint. Just approach life that way, and things will work their way out. And you'll know, depending on how you feel about your life overall, and you'll know because of the way others interact with you. And you will continue to have good, positive interactions, and you will continue to have not-so-positive interactions. I'm trying not to be either-or here, because...
No, we're sharing a physical space here. Yeah. Hearing you reflect on where you are in your life compared to where you have been, maybe where even you'll go in the future, like, you're thriving, you're happy, you're joyful. You also have all the other spectrum of feelings, right?
Yeah,
and experiences, like, grateful to be alive. Like, this is, this is a little bit maybe TMI, but definitely personal, which is not off-brand for me in any way. Like, on this specific journey, this road trip, right, this kind of the backstory and context of this whole first season, I knew that there would be emotional impact. What I didn't realize was just how out of touch with sitting with feelings I was. Was like, as soon as I felt a big feeling, instead of sitting with it and acknowledging it and letting it pass through me, it was like, what do I do about it? And so I hear you saying, take the actions, it's in the actions. And I wonder if there are listeners who are in a similar situation where they're like, they feel the feelings, maybe they're overcome with the feeling, or they let the feeling take them over, or fixate on a feeling, like, I'm angry and I'm just gonna be mad, right?
So this is a great story with that one.
We love stories.
So yes. Someone wrongs you, okay? And you're very upset about it. And you fixate on it, like you said. That's the equivalent of picking up a hot coal, holding that coal in your hand as tight as you can, and saying, the other person is going to be burned.
Yeah.
The other person doesn't even know you're holding the hot coal.
Right.
You do. You know you're choosing to hold it. You know you're being burned. And that's a lot of suffering. It's not affecting the other person at all. So why not put the coal down? It's okay. You picked up the coal. You experienced the coal. You had the feeling that went with the heat in your hand. Let that wash over you. That's perfectly normal. Don't try and shut that down. But if you continue to hold it, you're the only one who gets burned. Likewise, if you pick up stones every time you get angry, eventually you can't move forward because you've got a pack of stones on your back.
Too damn heavy. Yeah, you're stuck.
Put them down. Lighten your load. You don't need to grasp onto that stuff. It's okay that you had that. That's part of the experience of being human. How we suffer in life is dependent on how we react to those moments. How we examine them, perfectly okay. And then how we react. We see so many people, they get stuck in a very narrow viewpoint of life and they have a lot of suffering. And we can look around and see it. Especially in American society, we can see a lot of suffering right now. I could choose to be upset because some of that anger is affecting how I live, but I'm trying to understand from the other person's viewpoint why they're so angry. If we really deeply look at it, they haven't received the education they think they need to receive. They haven't received the opportunities they think they need to receive. They haven't been able to get out of a certain economic position that doesn't give them what they see all around them, marketed right and left. All of a sudden now, I've said, wow, I feel bad. I feel bad that that's where they're at, and they don't have a way out. So what can I do? Like, how can I turn what could be something that I could take as painful and make it a positive experience? For me, it's just being out there and being who I am and talking to people. And when I see people who are doing everything they can to get ahead, to help, like, here's my hand, and let me help you. You know, just because I don't want to see you suffering. Yeah. And if you can get past your suffering, then you can help others get past their suffering. So, you know, when I, again, when I look across what's happening right now, I experience the suffering, I have my emotions, but I think I try and understand it because I believe, and I will believe this until I pass, that people want to have positive outcomes, positive lives. They want to be loving. They want to be caring. They don't choose to be the way they are. We talked about this earlier, right? No one gets up and grows as a child and says, I'm going to be a criminal when I grow up. That is a result of the circumstances that they experience where they don't know any different. They need food. They don't have a choice but to break into a store and get food. They need money to clothe themselves. They have to figure out a way to get clothes. They don't do these things because they're evil. They don't have evil intent. Over time, they may become bitter because of the situation because they're suffering. But we can address that. We can address all these things. As a country, right now, we have a choice. We can make things, we could help each other, put the hand down, help each other up, or we could put the hand out and push each other down. I still believe that most people, and I will say this to everybody every day, want to help each other up. Regardless of your religion, regardless of how you became an American citizen, regardless of all that, most people want to be good. Because we have a contract with each other about how we want to live as a society. And it's based upon great principles. Now we're at a point where we just have to decide, are we going to live by those principles or not? What kind of change do we want? And I am optimistic and I am hopeful that we will say, we're going to change drastically to help everybody. That is our commitment to each other.
I share that hope. As far as actions and feelings go, something else that kind of came to mind is, like, based on the environment that I grew up in, the models of relationships that I was shown, I couldn't distinguish feeling from action in the context of anger. I thought anger and violence were the same. And it took a therapist pointing out, anger is the feeling, violence is the behavior. Something else too is, like, you can't outrun or outdo a feeling. The feeling's gonna be there. If you bury it, it's still in there. Mm-hmm. Right? If you don't feel it, if you don't make space for it. When I hear you talking about suffering, that is a big principle of Buddhism, I know, as well. Life is suffering. You can't not have it, right? But as you pointed out, it's, you have the choice and the agency. How do you react to that? You know, and especially too, just to kind of echo your sentiments in the moment in time that we're in right now, especially Americans, people here dealing with what we're dealing with. Like, I hear a lot of people say, like, the most radical thing you can do is be yourself and have a good time. Like, in spite of all of this, like, cling on to whatever. Now I've got to be careful because that's attachment too. You know, but living your authentic self, doing something every day that brings someone else joy, brings you joy, how else are we going to get through it, you know?
Yeah. Well, and we don't need to take big actions. There's a book that came out. I bought it. Have not read it. Apologize. Which basically says you can do micro rebellions. Yes. Little things that you can do. Okay? Mm-hmm. Very simple things. So you see someone. I'll use someone who's transgender because I can identify with that. And they don't pass. So I'm using quotation marks to say pass because I don't believe there's such thing as passing, but some people use that term. And for some reason, they're being harassed on the sidewalk. You could do something as simple as walk in between the harasser and that person, put your arm on them and say, walk with me. You've broken up that situation. You've taken them out of that area. You, as an individual, have said by your action to that person, this isn't acceptable. You haven't confronted them. You haven't started a fight. You've just done what the simplest thing you could do. You've just shown through action compassion. So if we all start doing these micro rebellions, imagine the change we're going to create. I'll go back to that wave in the ocean, right? That's a wave action. We get enough wave action, we have an ocean. How great is that? It's very simple. Anyone can do it.
As we're moving into the megaphone segment, the final segment for today, you know, this is all about advocacy, amplification, megaphone as a metaphor for, you know, what do you need to say and say loudly? I also think of calls to action. So maybe just kind of piggybacking off of the magnifying glass segment where you reference these micro rebellions. What feels important to say out loud and clear for people? And again, what do we do about it, right? What are maybe some small actions? If you had any advice or insight to give someone who feels stuck, right?
For me, when I face those things that make me nervous or scared, I know those are moments when I have to push through. Because in those experiences when I push through, I've grown tremendously. I've discovered amazing things, right? 2 years ago, you posted on LinkedIn that if someone was in the LGBTQ community and they were looking to brand themselves, that you were donating some time. I was terrified. I wanted to brand myself, but I was terrified to do it at the same time. And that's when I said, I have to do it. And I reached out to you. Now, not only have we had a great business relationship, and from a concept that was half-baked on my part to realizing a business that is feeds my soul today, and then doing this, that is such a wonderful experience for me. We can do this all with everything. We can do this for the simplest things. I've never had scrambled eggs because I think they look squishy and weird. Uh-huh. Well, I'm going to try having the scrambled eggs. Right. That's a small thing, right? Mm-hmm. That's a very small thing. You can do all these things. You don't have to do bold things, but you can do bold things. For me, it's being out there and being present as I am, right? Doing podcasts, not being afraid to go do the things that everyone else is doing. People may see me. They may hear my voice. They may look at me and say, something's off about her. Maybe she's transgender. But I'm hoping that when they get to meet me and see me as a person, they forget the transgender piece. It's such an insignificant piece of who I am, right? It's a little part of my story, just like being a Marine is a little part of my story. Just like growing up with, two brothers and a divorced mom is a little part of my story. None of those things defines me. None of those things defines who any of you are. You may have had a criminal past. You may have done time in prison and you've gotten out. You're no longer a criminal. You're no longer a prisoner. You're now just a person at a different period in your life. You could choose to walk through life saying, I'm nothing but a criminal. Or you could say, I paid my time. Now I'm a landscaper. Or I'm an artist. Or
both.
Those things, which is great, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm told I have way too many hobbies, but I just want to taste everything that there is out there.
Absolutely.
I just want to live authentically. Have people meet me, and then by the virtue of meeting me and not hiding who I am to them, then all of a sudden they start to say, I'm going to go into a community that I don't normally go into, and I'm going to go meet people there, and I'm going to interact with them so I can learn about different ways of life and the variety of life. I'm not going to just stay in the U.S. I'm going to go to Japan and spend a couple weeks there. I'm going to go to China, mm-hmm. because I hear so much about China in my country. But I'm only hearing it from this one national viewpoint. I'm going to go over there and experience China and see what China's all about. Almost guarantee if you go over there, you're going to discover a whole new world of art, architecture, science. Amazing, right? But in the country that we live in, you and I live in, they're vilified. There's people like you and I. Yeah. Imagine if there was a country of transgender people. If you didn't go over there and visit the country, you wouldn't know what living in that country of transgender people was like. So go over there and check it out, experience it. You push through these fears. Like, live. That's what it's all about. Come out of the shell. Just push yourself. Be comfortable with being uncomfortable.
That's huge. It actually makes me think of when I was making the decision, and it took me a while to process and even I'll say, like, get the nerve up to quit my job and start a business at the beginning of the pandemic. You know, I consulted with a person who advised me to be really careful about making choices based on fear. And it's so interesting and like a fresh perspective to hear someone else really describe like what I knew about myself, which is, yeah, like fear is a motivator, but not to make me run away or not to make me not take action. It's the inspiration. If I'm afraid of this, I'm going to look it right in the eyes. And we're going to go on that journey together because, like you, at the end of that experience, I tell my clients this all the time, at the end of this is personal growth. You're not going to be the same. I mean, you are still you. But I also think one of my dearest friends who you got to meet today, they say all the time, we contain multitudes, right? Like, there's you are more than the sum of the adjectives that mm-hmm. describe you, the actions that you've taken over the course of your mm-hmm. lifetime. I mean, I just think that's really cool just to know that. Hopefully there are listeners out there who feel the same way too. Like fear, you know, especially if you're tied up in like scarcity mentality, that can be really unhealthy and dangerous. You know, you might find yourself getting stuck. You know, you're just afraid. You're afraid of doing the wrong thing. You're afraid of doing the right thing. You're just afraid, right? So you're not able to move forward. But it's very inspiring to hear, like, you know, I'm scared of this. And also, it's humbling to hear that you were nervous to reach out to me because I'm like, oh my gosh, look where we are now. If you hadn't taken that step, if I hadn't taken a step, hadn't taken that chance on myself, if I hadn't created space for others to feel those fears and that be okay, right? Like, how can we make this fear work in our favor? Like, what can we do about it? I'd be in a much different place. Don't be afraid of that fear. Don't be afraid of your fear. Look at it. Sit with it. See what it might, you know, what are you?
Times on the other side of fear is joy. You won't know right? until you pull back the curtain. And time's ticking. Every day you don't pull back the curtain is another day gone. Another one less opportunity to do it.
Yeah.
I think it really came home to me. Yeah, 2 or 3 years ago, I was forced out of a job because of who I am. And I'd never been without work. So I was like, who am I? I didn't have emails to respond to. I didn't have texts to respond to. I didn't have executives to talk to. Never been there before. I didn't know what the world was.
That's pretty scary.
Yeah. And probably a week and a half, 2 weeks after, I discovered, oh, wow, this is freedom. I don't have to answer to anyone. I don't have to get up and do anything in the morning. I don't have to keep a schedule. This is what true freedom is like. And I embraced it, and I loved it. Two good things about that, right? I experienced something I was afraid of, but then I was no longer afraid of it. I realized I didn't have to take a job that I didn't like. I didn't have to stay at a job I didn't like. I didn't have to be verbally abused or gaslit, you know? Now, that was a decision a fear I didn't necessarily want to face, but I had to go through it. And I did find joy on the other side.
That willingness to look and discover is really powerful. Thank you for taking a chance on yourself, for being willing to be your authentic self. I think a lot of us hold ourselves back from that. And it's suffering on an individual level, but you also rob others of the opportunity to know you. And I just feel like this is such a gift.
That's exactly it, right? Buddhists will tell you that's a gift. When people accept opportunities and receive opportunities as a gift you're exchanging between each other. It's a beautiful thing.
Attention Confidential is sponsored, produced, and distributed by Self Magnitude LLC, an ethical microbusiness on a mission to transform how you see yourself. It is hosted by Maggie Green, personal brand and style strategist for weirdos and queerdos of all ages and gender expressions, who is also the face and voice behind Self Magnitude, helping people feel seen since 2020. If you're looking for support on embodying all aspects of your identity and showing up as your radically authentic self in person, in print, and online, please visit Maggie's 100% DIY website at selfmagnitude.com. The original music, as featured on Attention Confidential, was written, composed, and produced by Christopher Colley Biondi
a deaf pianist, composer, and dear friend in Central Kentucky, who generously provided his skills and talent to support the launch of this podcast. That's all for this episode of Attention Confidential, but of course the conversation doesn't end here. I encourage you to keep exploring, keep questioning, and most of all, keep sharing your stories. If today's conversation spoke to you, please pass it on. And if you have a story of your own you'd like to showcase, I am here and ready to listen. You can find all past and future episodes at selfmagnitude.com/podcast. And until next time, remember this. Your voice matters.